And good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another edition of Warrior Connection. Well, down here in Illinois, we're still a lot of snow and very, very cold. We're going to sub-zero again tonight and the first few days of this week, and hopefully we might get some sunshine, a little bit of warm weather. Well, one thing we have to remember, and again, all the military personnel, myself and everybody, we've been embroiled in the Middle East for a long, long time. And when I mean embroiled, I mean we set things up, our nation, in order to control a lot of parts of the Middle East, and that goes to all the resources and everything else. Well, obviously, you know, we've gone to war in Iraq and everything. We've been baiting Iran for a long, long time. And tonight we're going to have a conversation about Iran and find out what's going on, what's happening, what's the future hold, and where we're at. To help me with that, I'd like to introduce Patricia Axelrod, who will then introduce our guest tonight. Patricia, welcome.
Hello, Doug. Well, we're going to talk about Iran, but tonight we're going to be speaking with Maria Santelli, who is the executive director of the Center on Conscience and War. Maria, are you with us?
Yes, I am. Good evening to you both and to everyone listening.
Oh, good evening, my dear. So naturally, when we speak of war, our thoughts go to Iran, but which we hope will not come to pass, that boots will not be on the ground in Iran. But we know for a fact, unfortunately, that we have been embroiled in war in Iraq and in Afghanistan for some time now. And I know that the Center on Conscience and War has a great interest in this war and in other wars. Tell us what the Center on Conscience and War is and where you're located. And for those soldiers who are listening and perhaps have come to regret the commitment they've made to the military and the service that they're now giving to the military, this is going to be an extremely important program. So, Maria, tell us what the Center on Conscience and War is.
Sure. Thank you so much for the opportunity. Well, the Center on Conscience and War is of the larger GI Rights Hotline Network, and we do general military counseling to all service members who are facing any kind of human or civil rights issue in the course of their service. And then the Center on Conscience and War has particular focus on conscientious objection. And I want to say, just to tie to the initial comment in the beginning, it will be, just like it was with Syria, just like the talk of invading Syria, bombing Syria, starting an actual conflict, war with Syria, it will be, in the case of Iran, our service members who will have some of the loudest voices in opposition because they have seen enough of war. And I think it's a common thread that we know throughout history that those who have experienced war are the ones who will always have the loudest voices against war. So that's what we aim to do. We help those service members who, for whatever reason, have had a crisis of conscience and realize that they can no longer take part in the killing and in the dehumanization that is military life in large part in general, but particularly war and combat.
And Maria, these folks are called conscientious objectors. Is that right?
Yes. Now, folks listening, you asked also, Patricia, where are we located? We're in Washington, D.C., and we're located on the web at centeronconscience.org or GIRightsHotline.org. And, conscientious objectors, folks listening may equate that term with the draft. Of course, one of our most famous conscientious objectors is Muhammad Ali, who was drafted during the Vietnam era and resisted conscription for matters of conscience, for reasons of conscience. But there are folks still today in the absence of a draft. I want everyone to know that conscientious objection is alive and well. And there are folks who have voluntarily joined. Obviously, there's no draft and hasn't been since 1975. And these are folks who have actively, voluntarily joined the military and then have a crisis of conscience. And based on the old draft law, there is Department of Defense, DOD, military policy by which these folks can actually apply for discharge as conscientious objectors. And that's where we come in. We help them navigate through the process and make the best possible application they can. Make the, you know, the burden is on them to prove that they object to their participation in war, and that this is, you know, this is a controlling force in their life. This is dictating, their conscience is dictating everything that they do. And they make that application to the Department of Defense, and they're discharged with any luck, with any skill, and with the purity of their conscience, of course, the sincerity of their beliefs. They're discharged.
Probably and one of the most famous conscientious objectors, we're going to go back to World War One, was Sergeant Alvin York, who obviously was a massive conscientious objector, but then made the decision to go on in the military, obviously, and, you know, we all know the history of what happened there. But weren't conscientious objectors sometimes that to get in the military, couldn't they request, even if they were in the military, to be put into non-combat roles where they're medics or chaplains or something like this also?
Yes, exactly. They certainly could. So they would be given non-combat duty, or the classification called 1AO. Folks from who are listening who remember the draft days, you got your classification 1A or 1O if you were a conscientious objector, and then there's 1AO, which is you serve in the military, but you do alternative non-combat service. And that is still, again, as I mentioned, the DOD policy today is based on the old draft law. So we still have some of that terminology. And a person, a volunteer, you know, someone who has volunteered for the military and then becomes a conscientious objector, they can decide to apply for non-combat status. And that is a very rare path chosen, and it's even more rarely granted by the military these days in the era of a voluntary military. So most people in today's military will actually be discharged as COs. But our organization started in 1940 to provide alternative service, to provide an infrastructure for alternative service. Because back in World War One, there was not a mechanism in place for conscientious objectors. But there were conscientious objectors. As long as there's been war, there's been conscientious objectors. And these folks in World War One were treated with such prejudice. They were treated so terribly and so abysmally. People were beaten to death by police when they were apprehended or you know, tortured in prison and died as a result of their confinement. There were actually 17 people who were sentenced to death. No one was actually executed, but many, many of these men died. And the folks that started our organization 73, almost 74 years ago, saw the handwriting on the wall in 1940 that the United States was entering World War II, that it was inevitable, and they didn't want the same thing to happen to conscientious objectors in World War II that had happened in World War One. And
one
so,
things,
oh, go ahead. Sorry.
One of the things I think that comes into play here, and just in my own family, I mean, we're looking at World War One and World War II, where again, fighting against primarily Germany. And in that case, just like the American Civil War, we had families were intermingled still, where we still had family members, you know, coming from Germany, you know, where there again you've got family members fighting against family members in some sense. So now you've got all of that whole thing, crisis of conscience and crisis of, you know, who am I fighting against, you know?
That's very true. And the military has responded. You know, the war machine has responded. I mean, some people would say, you know, blood is not the only thing, or that kind of, you know, consanguinity, sharing of blood is not the only thing that constitutes a family. And most of us believe that. Most of us are hardwired to understand that killing is wrong and that taking another human life is wrong. And when you look at the data, and these studies have been reproduced and proven to be accurate, when you look at the data, the shoot-to-kill rates were once very, very low, especially when people were in the trenches and looking eye to eye at their quote-unquote enemy, their opponent. And so in World War One, the numbers show us that 5% of those men shot to kill. World War Two, about 15%. By Vietnam, 90% of individuals were shooting to kill. And that's because the military learned how to adjust the training to make it scientifically based for the express purpose of circumventing the conscience, to get the individual to act instead of think, instead of filter it through their conscience. Because if we filter it through our conscience, then we know that taking another human life is wrong.
Well, I remember when I went through my training, coming in the 1960s and went over to Vietnam and that whole area. I mean, the sayings, I mean, you were totally indoctrinated all the time. You know, kill a commie for Christ, you know, kill a commie and let Christ sort them out, all this stuff. I mean, this was just inbred into you completely. And then we went over to Iraq and Saudi Arabia and Kuwait for Operation Desert Storm. It was the same thing. I mean, absolutely, totally, without hesitation, continuous bombardment on the psychological bombardment to get you to accept what's going on by belittling these individuals beyond all humanity.
Do you think it's easier to do this when the so-called enemy looks different from you? For instance, as we speak of the kill rate increasing, so from World War One to World War Two, when we were fighting Europeans, essentially Germans, and then in Vietnam we're fighting Asian people, and in Iraq we're fighting, of course, Middle Eastern people, people whose culture is different than ours. Do you think, Maria and Doug, that that has something to do with it? Improving the kill rate, does that make for an easier inculcation to kill?
I think certainly there's no question that the dehumanization is part of it. Absolutely it is. And I'll tell you, we learn so much from our conscientious objectors. We get such a privileged peek into military life and military training. And we had a young man who was in the Navy, an African-American guy who was in the Navy. So immediately he's a minority because it's just how it is. In the Defense Language Institute where he was the only African-American person. And he had been through training, and he was ready to do whatever he needed to do in support of the war effort. And this is, of course, in today's time period, so we're talking about Middle Eastern people. And he bought into the dehumanization. He used the same slangs and laughed at the same jokes. And then one night, when people were drinking and, you know, getting a little out of hand, the dehumanization was turned on him, and he was the only African American man there in a sea of white faces and a sea of white people getting drunk. The dehumanization and the jokes and the ridicule was aimed now toward him, and that was his crystallizing moment. That was the time when he understood what it felt like, what he was doing to these other people, marginalizing, exposing difference and highlighting difference instead of the shared and common humanity that we all have. That was his crystallizing moment when he felt it himself, that dehumanization and that separateness. And he realized that that's what the military as an institution was based on, was making that divide and making an us and them type of scenario. And that was the moment he decided that he needed to get out and apply as a conscientious objector.
Well, one of the other problems I think we run into, and this is where I've been directly involved, and Patricia, you've done an incredible amount of research on this, is the weapon systems we have today. We're separating the killing out from everything else. So by using the new technology and separating the killing, is that in a sense a way to get around this conscientious objection thing or anything else where there is no direct contact with anything?
I think very much so. I think that the military knows that the human conscience is the fallible piece of the human being, right? You can train the body to be athletic and to have endurance, and you can try and train the mind and the hand to respond rote, you know, with nothing but reaction. But the conscience, you can dull the conscience and you can subjugate the conscience, but only temporarily. The conscience will always come back. And so this mechanization of warfare that we're seeing, drones, of course, everyone knows the unmanned aerial vehicles. These are the most common, the most readily available example to us in modern warfare. So cutting out that need for the human-to-human contact. And I think that that, in a sense, has backfired, though, because what we're seeing is equal or greater instances of trauma, of moral injury occurring in the drone pilots, as we see in people that are actually on a field of battle. And I think one of the reasons for that is that if you kill someone on the field of battle, you may be able to justify it. You may be able to say, I was in danger, or someone I care about was in danger. They were going to get me before, you know, so I needed to get them first. But if you're sitting in the desert of Nevada or the plains of New Mexico, and you're sitting in a little cubicle with a joystick and a screen, there's no possible way that your conscience can justify that there was any threat to you whatsoever. So to your conscience. That was that injury. That is a transgression against the conscience. That killing doesn't make sense. It doesn't make any sense because there was no personal threat.
You're leaping into an incredible area right now. My mind is sitting here spinning because what I'm thinking is what we call post-traumatic stress disorder today. We had, you know, it goes back, shell shock, you know, battle fatigue. I mean, how many different names? It's all the same thing. But myself and all the conversations I've had in working with this, Patricia and I have talked about this and other individuals, almost in a sense what you've described and where you're leading into it is the PTSD historically from Vietnam, which is affecting the Vietnam vet and is now ripping apart Desert Storm and OIF-OEF beyond any comprehension, resulting in suicides and everything. Do you think, and I'm beginning to really go in this direction, do you think that the moral injury is by far the most significant type of casualty that we have today in warfare from Vietnam onward and what we're going to see in the future?
And let's clarify this. The term moral injury is one that, interestingly enough, was first identified by the VA. They seem to have an intrinsic understanding of the fact that to kill on the field of war is to sabotage the soul. They understand this, but yet they are not addressing it as so. The term moral injury is something now that we are not hearing in the VA, despite their recognition of this. Mm. Please go on, Maria.
No, I think it's something that is we're going to start seeing more and more. We're going to start acknowledging, I'm hoping, more and more. But yes, absolutely. I think this term that we've used, and it has, we've come a long way to recognize, even to have the terminology of post-traumatic stress disorder. But I think we're evolving even further and understanding post-traumatic stress, that the D is going to be dropped, and that we're going to use these terms, moral injury, more and more, and understanding that if you don't feel remorse, there's where the disorder lies, that this is a common response to a grisly situation. I don't think anyone would deny that the battlefield is grim and a horrible experience. And the fact that in our modern warfare, 90% of the casualties are civilians, are non-combatants, that is, I think, incredibly traumatic. We're raised our whole lives to know that taking another human life is wrong. And then we go into military training, and all of that is stripped away. And we're taught to act simply by reaction and simply by rote, and we end up taking another human life. We act in a way that is a transgression against our conscience, or we fail to act. I think many of these instances of moral injury are failure to act, failure to stop something, or inability to stop something that you know is wrong. And so what do we see then in society? What are we seeing? Of course, we're going back to Vietnam. We don't have a lot of statistics, but what we do know, and I mean this with the utmost love and respect for our service members and veterans, but I grew up with the image in my head of the crazy Vietnam veteran, right? How many of us have been indoctrinated with that? We like to assign personal deficiency. There's something wrong with you, that you couldn't handle it. You couldn't get past it. There's something wrong with you. So we have this stereotype. Instead of looking and blaming and getting to the real heart of what has happened, of how this person has had their soul injured, has experienced this moral injury. But that quote-unquote, you know, crazy Vietnam veteran who's living on the street, hundreds of thousands of veterans on the street at any given night, about 250,000 veterans, one full third of homeless adults on the street are veterans. New numbers from Iraq and Afghanistan, 48,000 Iraq and Afghanistan veterans on the street experiencing homelessness. Domestic violence. If you're a military family member, you are four times as likely to experience domestic violence. Of course, sexual assault. You're three times as likely in the military than in the outside world to experience sexual assault. And then, of course, the suicides, which are probably the most staggering numbers of all. Veterans make up 7% of the population in the United States, yet they are 22% of the suicides. And that's using conservative numbers. that from the DOD, the latest numbers from the DOD that I have found, if anyone has any more recent ones, please let me know, but 22 veterans a day are killing themselves and one active duty service member. More active duty service members are dying by their own hand. 2010, 2011, 2012, and as far as we have the data already compiled for 2013, we're seeing the same thing. One active duty suicide a day and 22 veteran suicides a day. What's happening here? I think there's a very clear link between that injury to the soul and this despondence that we're seeing and this violence that carries over once folks are discharged or in a lot of cases, kicked out.
Well, I think one of the other problems, and this goes back to my days, I mean, I first enlisted back in 1967 and then stayed in and finally retired in 2009. But the type of individual that the military is enlisting today with all the waivers for everything they have in order to get them in to go over to Iraq and Afghanistan, the sheer numbers that they needed, we've been seeing and bringing a lot of individuals have incredible cultural and social problems to begin with that don't have, to me, I don't think they have the background, the foundation, they don't have the support network in place to handle these crises that they encounter in combat. So once they go through that and then they get back home, all we got is a time bomb.
I think you're exactly right. Oh, I'm sorry.
Many of these people are extremely young going in. And, you know, they've got delayed deployment. They're signing them up at 17. The recruiters going into the high school and signing up young men and women at 17, and then they have a delayed deployment and they go in at 18. And we know full well, certainly there's a basis of research to support this, that young people at 18, 19, that their brains are not fully developed. So it's very easy to inculcate these young folks at that point and to make them killers, so to speak, to teach them how to kill. And then when they come out, they're lost. They're entirely lost. Their whole way of life is now stripped away from them and removed from them. So if they're no longer can kill as a way of life, so to speak, where will they go from there?
It's exactly right. There's so many, I mean, you know, there's so many layers to all the things you've just said, Patricia. I mean, I think, yes, if you're young and you don't have a lot of opportunities available to you, so many times, unless you're in ROTC and you're on an officer track, then you may come from some privilege and you may come from, you know, some family support. But overall, though we don't have a draft in this culture, we have a mandatory draft, we have a different kind of draft. You know, only 1% of the population voluntarily joins the military. Only 1%. And most of those people are looking for some kind of opportunity. They're looking for something bigger than themselves. They're looking to serve, no question about it. They're looking for identity. They're looking for connection. They're looking for security, inclusion, all those things that so many of them might have been lacking. And I think, Doug, I think it was who made the point, or I'm not sure which one of you, that when you go in kind of broken or maybe not so whole, it's so much harder on the outside when you come out to find that healing. People who go in whole already and have a support network fare much better. There's no question that they still do suffer from some of these traumas. There's no question, because war and military life are hard and they're foreign from what most of us live through every day. So, but if you go in more whole, then you come out and you're going to fare better. Then we fall short as a society. We fall short, and the Department of Defense and the Veterans Administration fall short. And I think some of it is that they don't want to acknowledge. And we as a culture are afraid to acknowledge what war does to people. Because if we acknowledge it, then we have to own it. Then we have to have some shared accountability. And we're unwilling to do that.
Well, I would say that, I mean, we don't have a draft per se, but I would say that we definitely have a cultural and economic draft, because the majority of the individuals that have come into the military, and I'm going to go back with my own experience as a, you know, military NCO and then an officer involved in training and education and writing everything, I see way, way too many individuals enlisting in the military that have subpar education. In other words, even they might have graduated from high school, but they don't really have a high school education. They don't have the reading, the math, the science ability, so they get in the military, and they go through the whole thing. Now it turns into a nightmare. Then they come on out. Now they're going to look for jobs. And this old thing, this old adage, and I think it's pure nonsense, well, if you're in the military, you earned a job or you got trained to do the stuff. I mean, when I think about the stuff I just did in my training in the area of nuclear, biological, chemical warfare, avionics, medicine, and all this stuff, the training that we gave to the military personnel was maybe the equivalent of one college course. So, I mean, it's definitely deficient in preparation for a job or an employment. So now they got all of these moral and ethical crises. They come out, they don't have the academic or vocational skills or training for employment. To me, I mean, it's a time bomb.
It is. Absolutely it is. And if, at so many of these cases, the military is in a terrible state of denial with trauma and moral injury in so many of these cases, because it would be overwhelming. We've had so many multiple deployments. We've had so many service members overburdened by these multiple deployments and these very traumatic and long and trying deployments. And then there's the refusal to diagnose properly and the refusal to treat properly. And so a lot of these kids, and I will say kids because so many of them are young. Now again, I want to underscore, not only do we work with conscientious objectors, but as part of the GI Rights Hotline, we get calls from everyone, and anyone is welcome to call the GI Rights Hotline for any issue you're facing in the course of your service. The most common call we're getting is involuntary separation, people getting kicked out. And too many times, they're being kicked out because of some misconduct they've engaged in directly related to their undiagnosed or untreated trauma. So they're self-medicating. Maybe they're drinking or using street drugs, or they get into a fight, or they, you know, disrespect their command. Something that is directly related to their trauma.
Well, you know, they got the trauma. They got both psychological trauma and they got physiological trauma. And then they get put in. And then, again, we've seen all over. I mean, there's been investigation upon investigation where they're discharging these kids saying, well, you had some sort of personality disorder before, not realization. They sent them to war and they turned them into a post-traumatic stress nightmare where the kids have no capability to cope with it. There's no support system in place. They've got all these problems before they come into the military. Now they're all of a sudden getting dumped out of the military with no job and no education. What's going wrong here?
Well, I think an interesting point is, and Maria, you pointed this out to me in our discussion prior to this program, is that in between 2007 and 2008, the Department of Defense reported, was it 50,000 people went to AWOL during that period of time?
Yep.
Right. So that, too, is reflective of what's going on there. So many of these people might have actually been COs, people who had developed a moral repugnance to this war, to the war, and yet did not and were not aware of the process of becoming a CO. But in fact, the Department of Defense, as you told me, reported 50,000 people going AWOL at the height of the conflict in Iraq. And then I think you told me that 40 people a day between 2005 and to 2012 were reported as going AWOL by the Army alone. Is that correct?
Yep, we're turning themselves in. There are when someone in the Army goes AWOL, if they're outside the continental U.S. or if they are still in training, they can turn themselves in at what's called a personnel control facility. And there were at that time two. There's now just one. But at just one of those two sites, Fort Sill, Oklahoma, they were reporting 40 people a day turning themselves in. 40 AWOLs a day turning themselves in.
That's the ones just turning themselves in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's not counting the ones that are at large. That's also not counting the people who are what's known as permanent party, who were not eligible to turn themselves in at a personnel control facility and would have to go back to their own unit. So that's not counting those folks either. So now it's dropped significantly, obviously for a number of reasons. We no longer have two hot wars raging. The economy is terrible, and we've seen it actually flip. We've really seen it flip where what is happening most commonly now, and I don't know, I have no proof of this, but my guess is there's orders from the top telling units to save money. We don't want to take care of these people for the rest of their lives. If the military broke them, whether it's physically or psychologically or some combination of both, the military is not taking care of people in an adequate way. And people are being kicked out. And we hear these terms thrown around our culture. If you've honorably served, if you've been honorably discharged, well, you know what? About a full third of people do not receive fully honorable discharges, which means that they are cut out of their benefits. And the first thing to go is the GI Bill, which is, you know, the education benefits, which is what most people are looking forward to enjoying once they've served their time. So there, I believe, and again, this is my conjecture based on talking to hundreds and hundreds of people on the GI Rights Hotline, I believe that this is an intentional pattern of the military and the DOD not wanting to care for people, whether it is in you know, benefits of citizenship, you know, literally, because over 40,000 non-citizens have served in our military, many of whom are sitting deported now in border towns on the U.S. and Mexico. These are non-U.S. citizens who have served for the United States. So citizenship is a benefit that is promised and dangled in front of people to serve. And then if you mess up, if something happens, and again, I'm going to assert that this is in large part due to untreated or undiagnosed medical, either psychological or physical issues, people are discharged against their will. And that results in stripping of your benefits.
You just had a number that flew by me. It was staggering.
Oh, yeah.
You're saying that 33% of the individuals that go in the military are leaving the military without less than honorable conditions?
With a less than honorable discharge. Now, there's variations. So there's an honorable discharge. That's the best you could possibly get. Then there's a general discharge, which is under honorable conditions. That doesn't sound bad, right? But if you don't get a fully honorable discharge, your GI Bill is gone. The next step under that, which many, many people, if you're AWOL, if you go AWOL, or if you have misconduct, you're likely to get discharged with an other than honorable, OTH. And that cuts you out. That potentially, I mean, it would be an agency by agency and a case by case basis, but that could potentially cut you out of all of your VA benefits, all of your veterans benefits, regardless of the time that you've served, regardless of the good time that you've served. If you get an OTH, that could trouble you. You know, there could be prejudice that you face in the civilian world as well, getting hired for jobs if people see that. And a lot of times in the civilian world, people see other than honorable, and their mind goes straight to dishonorable. Now, that's not true. Dishonorable is a conviction, and you have to be court-martialed and convicted in order to get a bad conduct discharge or a dishonorable discharge. Those are very serious and very bad. Those are actually convictions. But a lot of folks end up getting an OTH or a general and don't enjoy the fully honorable discharge.
What work can these individuals go then? I mean, if you want to get an education, you can't use a GI Bill even if you contributed to it.
Mm-hmm.
You want to try to get into either vocational, again, to get some type of a skilled trade job, or if you want to get into the university or a college to get a 4-year degree. Now, doesn't that limit you as far as what type of job you may get in the future that requires some type of state licensing?
Not only does it limit you, Doug, it stigmatizes you. If you have something that is other than honorable discharge, then you're stigmatized by that.
Absolutely, and I want people listening to know, because we think that there must be something wrong with you. Again, we have this way about our culture where we want to assign personal deficiency, and we want to say, well, you couldn't hack it. Something is wrong with you, and I just know empirically and anecdotally that this is not the case, that a lot of these folks, yes, exactly what you're saying, their futures are devastated because so many times because of what happened in the course of their service, whether it is a psychologically disabling condition or a physically disabling condition. We see so frequently, that is the most frequent thing, it's untreated or undiagnosed medical issues, and people are being kicked out. And I firmly believe it's because the Department of Defense and the VA they don't want to take care of these people. You know, we won't cut the budget for a fighter jet, you know, that costs millions of dollars. We won't stop making nuclear weapons which we are. I mean, we are still making new plutonium triggers for nuclear weapons every day at Los Alamos National Laboratory in New Mexico, for people who don't know that. We won't cut budgets in those respects. Where we're cutting budgets is on the people who have served, and have served for all the right reasons, and have served very selflessly. And that's where we're penny wise and pound foolish.
And I'll remind everyone that we're going to be spending $1 trillion on a fleet of F-35 aircraft. That's $1 trillion that we're going to be spending. And yet we cannot invest in the future and the health and the welfare of these young people who have signed up for all the right reasons to serve in the military. Maria, I know there's a process to becoming a CEO. What is that process?
Oh, sure. So the person, the individual, has a crisis of conscience, whatever may have happened to that person. You know, there's a variety of things that happen. An interesting story is a young man who served under Robert Bales in Afghanistan. Folks listening may remember Robert Bales. He was the gentleman in Afghanistan who was faced multiple deployments. He had no business being redeployed. He was already sick, and it was very clear to the people around him. And he's the guy, he got out of his bed in the middle of the night and walked off base and pulled Afghan civilians out of their beds and shot them execution style. One of his subordinates became a conscientious objector after serving under him, because Robert Bales was so unstable and was ordering his subordinates to randomly kill innocent people themselves. And this poor kid who came to us as a conscientious objector was terrified that his sergeant, Robert Bales, was going to order him to fire at an innocent civilian. And thank God for him, he didn't have to do that. But it was his crystallizing moment. So for every CO, it's different. And there's a variety of things that trigger people and trigger their conscience. And once that happens, hopefully they find us. Center on Conscience and War, please spread the word. We feel terrible that we can't reach everyone who needs us. We know there are more people who need us and can't find us. But hopefully at that moment, they do some research, they get on the internet, they look up Conscientious Objector, and they find us. Then they write an application. There's policy on all the branches, across all the branches. It's very similar. They write an application. They have to answer 6 pretty standard essay questions about what they believe about their participation in war and how they came to those beliefs. And then they have to prove that those beliefs are the controlling force in their life. In the old days of conscientious objection law, you had to be religious. Your objection had to have a religious basis. Now today, the Supreme Court decided, one does not have to be religious, because the conscience can be as powerful, one's own conscience can be as powerful a guide as, for someone else, God can be. So you can be a moral or ethical objector. You do not have to be religious. But you do have to show, through your application, that these beliefs are a controlling force in your life, the way God would be in someone who is very religious.
Where do they begin? I mean, if you're on active duty, can you go to your unit or your chaplain? Can they go to the medics? Where do they begin this? Because if they're having a crisis, they have to have some place to turn to, don't they?
Oh, yes, and we hope so. I mean, a lot of times, though, as you can imagine, people are treated, they're met with hostility when they declare themselves conscientious objectors, or when they are having a crisis of conscience. Sometimes they're met with great hostility. And I think a lot of that comes from guilt. I think most of us know in our heart of hearts that killing is wrong. Most of us accept that. And when it's put out there, it's sad for morale, you know, for the rest of the unit, because I believe deep down most people in the military are thinking that. I'm sure they're hoping and praying in their heart of hearts that they don't have to be faced with a situation where they're going to have to take another human life. So sometimes it isn't a very open situation. Sometimes these folks will go to their command, or they'll go to the chaplain, and they'll be treated with prejudice. And they'll be ridiculed, or they'll be reprimanded, or they'll be tried to, you know, they'll try to talk them out of it and tell them, oh, it's just a passing phase, you know, you'll get over it, suck it up, something like that. Because a lot of times commands and chaplains aren't trained enough to know how to help conscientious objectors. It's the law. when a person makes an application for conscientious objection, the DOD or that, you know, each particular branch is obligated to follow through with that claim. It cannot be ignored by law. They cannot ignore it. So, yes, they can go to their command, and many do. Others don't feel comfortable going to their command. So that's, again, when we hope they'll at least find the GI Rights hotline and get to us through that way, or hopefully directly find the Center on Conscience and War. And we help them.
The process takes about 7 months, doesn't it, Maria, from start to finish?
It's not a speedy process. It is a long process because there's an investigation that happens. It's a very serious process on the DOT side. You can see that they take this very, very seriously. And I think that's probably for a number of reasons, not the least important of which I believe is that conscientious objection is a threat. Going back to, again, something that I think the military knows very well, and that is that the human conscience is opposed to killing and always will be. And so if conscientious objection is out there and it becomes part of the military culture, that's a threat to the culture of killing and the culture of war. So it's a very serious process. And the individual objector makes their application, and then they submit it to their command. They're required to have a chaplain interview because they say that, you know, the military believes the chaplain is the one that's equipped with the tools and the training to be able to see into one's heart and into one's soul and see and measure the level of sincerity that person has. And then they meet with a psychiatrist, and the psychiatrist makes an evaluation. And it is stated very clearly that a psychiatric evaluation has two purposes. Yes, they want to make sure the person is in the sound mind, you know, to be able to go through this process. But the military also wants to see if there's another way they can get rid of this person and not have CO on the books, not have a conscientious objector tallied on the books. So they have the psych eval, then an investigating officer is appointed. If the objector is an officer, it's somebody with a higher rank. If it's an enlisted person, then it's just, you know, just any officer, you know, who's available and qualified enough to do the job. And I must say there's not a lot of training, and investigating officers, some of them don't even read the regulation. They don't even really know what their job is. And that's why, again, it's so important that people have counsel. They're entitled to counsel. It's not a legal process. It's an administrative process, so they don't need a lawyer. We suffice. We are legally able to, you know, take part in the hearing and cross-examine witnesses, et cetera, and help this person navigate through the process, which a lot of times their command is not very versed in.
Very, very slowly, very succinctly, please tell everybody how do they your name of your organization, phone number, emails, or websites. Very slowly so everybody can get it.
Sorry, thank you. It's because I'm from Jersey. I talk fast. I'm sorry.
No, you speak very well, and you tell it like it is. We just want to be sure that anybody who's interested in going down this path will call you. As I understand it, dear, you have about a 97% success rate, and if a soldier tries alone, they've only got about a 56% success rate.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's according to the GAO. They did a study, and their numbers are very low, but their numbers are problematic because, as I mentioned, you know, there may be a psychiatric reason why the person is separated. Their CO process may not go through from beginning to end. So the numbers of the GAO study, we don't feel are very good numbers. But if someone works with us, I've been doing this counseling for 5 years. I've seen two people be denied. So our rates are pretty good when we help someone. So we are the Center on Conscience and War. And our website is just centeronconscience.org, centeronconscience.org. We're in Washington, D.C., 202-483-2220.
One more time, real slow. Phone number?
202-483-2220. And I also want to put out there the GI Rights Hotline. If you or a family member, regardless of your position about the war, we will help people just as strenuously who are being involuntarily separated, kicked out, as we help those who want to get out. I come to this from a peace perspective, but I think that as any amount of justice that is that is facilitated for members of our military, for people serving, I think is going to help this institution that is designed around injustice hopefully be a little bit more just in the world, if that makes sense.
So, can I clarify something for anyone who's listening, who's giving this serious thought right now? Please understand that if you should make a decision that that war is wrong, that it is, that to kill someone in an act of war is wrong for you, this is an act of bravery. This is not an act of cowardness. These people who are COs are not cowards. These are people who have taken and made a very brave decision. They've decided to follow their conscience, and this is an extremely brave act, and I just really want to clarify that. And Maria, I'm sure you'll second that, and Doug, I know you will as well.
One of the things that I've got to ask, okay, we've got a lot of us and a lot of people in the military, and again, I'm an Army officer through and through, retired, continued on and on forever and ever. When we have the ethical and moral crisis, we run into the massive moral injury. What recourse do we have? Where can we go? Who can we turn to? Who can that individual turn to for help? Because obviously, as you've already mentioned, you go to the commander and say, hey, boss, you know, hey, captain, you know, I got a problem, or colonel, I got a problem. Boy, you become ostracized in a heartbeat.
No, it's very true. I mean, obviously, this is really difficult for people because part of military culture is that isolation and that internal, you know, that insular, culture. So reaching out beyond that, if you are a combat veteran or an active duty member who has served in combat, I love and I really trust the Vet Center system. It is part of the VA, but there are these grassroots little outposts that are not located on the big, humongous, overwhelming VA campus, and they only serve combat veterans and their families, and it's veterans serving veterans, and I think that's so important. It's just Vet Center.
Maria, I'm going to disagree with you a little bit on this because some of these vet centers, which are quite excellent, a great number of them, though, have adopted that philosophy of stiff upper lip and suck it up. So while some of them are very good, I'm sorry to say my experience with them is a mixed bag.
I'm so sorry to hear that. I would love to know if there were individual ones, and I invite anyone to call us if you know of a bad one, because I want that information because I do refer people there. I'm so sorry to hear that. I've had really good experiences with vet centers in general. But I think as an individual, you have to know, that's a hard thing to ask somebody who's suffering from trauma, but know when to seek some other counsel, you know, if it's not meeting your needs or if it's trying to change your mind on how you really know you feel. There's a new movement afoot to train clergy, to train churches and lay people in churches, not just the clergy people, but lay people in the churches, congregants in the churches, on soul repair. There's the Soul Repair Center out of Bright Divinity School in Texas, and they're doing trainings all over the country. There's going to be one down at Quaker House in near Fort Bragg in North Carolina later this year. You can call us for information about maybe trainings in your area. There's also a Soldier's Heart, and they do reconciliation workshops and trips. They're not going to Iraq and Afghanistan yet, but I'm sure that'll be something they do in the future. Right now they're taking Vietnam veterans back to Vietnam to do healing and reconciliation. But their founder, Edward Tick, has been training people all over the country on issues of soul repair for a long, long time. So they do retreats for veterans and their families. They do women only retreats for female veterans. They do men's-only retreats. They'll do mixed retreats. So there are those options that are outside of the VA, outside of the government system. I know sometimes sending someone back to the VA is like, you know, going back to the dog that bit you. You know, I mean, who wants to do that? You know, I know that can be very painful. So it's important to look for places that are outside of the government system. I think that's why we are so credible, is that we're completely removed from the government. We have nothing to do with DOD or the VA. We're completely independent. So if those resources don't meet your needs, give us a call and we'll try to find someone who will.
What about the veterans organizations? Do you see those as helping or educated or knowledgeable, or is that, again, the good old boys network, suck it up and go into it?
Are we talking about the VFW, Doug?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know the answer to that, Doug, without even elaborating. Unfortunately, my experience, and I remind listeners that I conducted Desert Storm Think Tank and All Veterans Advocate, and I, too, am available to anyone who needs assistance. But unfortunately, my experience is that the VFW and other veterans organizations are beholden to the DOD and the VA, and that is exemplified by the fact that oftentimes you find them in, you know, situated, co-located with the VA. They're reliant upon them for their office space, for instance. And by and large, my experience has been that while they can be helpful in helping to resolve a service-connected claim, by and large, there's too much of a conflict of interest on their part. I don't know, Maria, what do you say?
I agree, and I think there is also that prejudice. Like, these older guys, they don't get it. They don't see how frequently this younger generation of veterans is discharged, you know, again, but through no fault of their own, with something less than a fully honorable discharge. And there's prejudice against this. It's a generational gap that I think is really hard to overcome. But of course, there's Iraq Veterans Against the War. There's coffee houses. There's DR resistance coffee houses. Now, there's not many of them. There's only three. There's one in Germany. And there's one in near Joint Base Lewis-McChord in Washington State called Coffee Strong, and there's one in near Fort Hood called Under the Hood. And these are drop-in centers, counseling centers where you can get GI rights counseling, where you could have solidarity, where you could just kick back and have a cup of coffee with people who get it. And of course, there's IVAW, Iraq Veterans Against the War, which is open to any veteran who has served since 9/11, 2001. It doesn't matter if you've been to combat or not. I think that trauma comes simply from military training. People are diagnosed with trauma simply after basic training. So there's no, you know, there's no prejudice there among these groups. And, there's chapters all over the country. Of course, there's Veterans for Peace. And so that you can find resources by hooking up with these, wonderful people as well.
You know, Maria, it seems like, you know, we got about 3 or 4 or 5 minutes left. We barely touched the iceberg here. And we definitely need to invite you back again. But in the last 3 to 4 or 5 minutes, can you give us a real clear summary for the individuals that are listening or having a problem? Very, you know, just sum it up. Or how do they get the help? What do they need to do? What are they experiencing? Or what? Yeah.
I think I want to speak to the audience, too. I want to speak to the listeners who are not veterans, or maybe I don't have experience with service members, because if you think of those numbers, again, 1% of people join the military, so very few of us really understand what military life and military service is like. And I think that we need to do better than slapping a yellow ribbon on the back of our car or that says support the troops, or stopping in an airport to applaud for a person in uniform. That's not enough. We need to really demand accountability and put our money where our mouth is and make sure that anybody who has served and has been injured and traumatized in our name, whether you support the war or not, I have no reason to believe that these folks who have joined for anything but all the right reasons. And so pay attention to what's going on with our veterans. Don't assign personal responsibility or personal accountability, or personal deficiency, I'm sorry. We can assign some personal responsibility, that's okay, but not personal deficiency to someone. Understand, as a culture at large, that war and military training is counter to the human instinct and to the human conscience, that the default position for humanity is that of conscientious objector to war. And when someone has seen something like war or combat or even gone through the dehumanizing that is military training, that they need our help and they need the full support of the culture. So don't turn your back on a veteran that you see on the street and welcome them home, but be careful with thanking people for their service, because that's, to them, to the military service member, to the veteran, that's sallow in light of all the other things that they're facing. They don't feel like we're grateful to them and to the sacrifice that they've made. Again, wherever you fall on the war. So tell service members that you know, veterans that you know, get the word out that there is a neutral source for support, the GI Rights Hotline, the Center on Conscience and War, and declare yourself a conscientious objector. It's not a dirty word, and create a safe space for people to be able to, for veterans and for active duty service members to be able to have an honest and open discussion about war and resistance to war.
So this phone number again, your phone number, GI Rights Hotline, is in Washington, D.C., and that phone number is 202-483-2220, correct?
That's it.
Maria, will you be able to come back on our radio show again at another time? I mean, we barely touched it. My mind is spinning here.
Well, I'm so pleased to have the opportunity. Thank you for the work that you do, and thank you for getting our work out there, the word of our work out there.
Wow. What kind of an individual wants to get involved with your organization to work with you or help you? How do they do that, or what training do they need, or where do they go, or how do? Yeah.
Obviously, it is important that people have extensive training, because we really are holding people's lives and people's futures in our hands. But there's GI Rights Hotline offices, 18 of them around the country. So there could be a chance there's one near you if you're listening. And you can give us a call, and we do trainings around the country on pretty regular bases. So you can get trained, and all the hotline offices are perpetually understaffed. Most of them are staffed by volunteers, many of them veterans themselves. So if you're interested in volunteering with a hotline, you can give us a call, and we can help you either hook up with an office nearby or get you hooked in, get you plugged in some other way. There's never any shortage of work to do.
Can you write up a paragraph for us for the archives and get that to Patricia and I, so we can get that on the archives for the recording of this radio show? You've done
Absolutely. So
much, Maria. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
Thank you. Oh, thank you.
Thank you, Maria. We wish you the best here.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, again, Progressive Radio Network and Warrior Connection is giving you education, information, and resources way beyond anything imagined on any other radio show. Thank you, and God bless America.
R-E-S-P-E-C-T, find out what it means to me. R-E-S-P-E-C-T, take out
CCT. Hi, everyone. Richard Martin here from the Wake Up Call with news for the show this